Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It has been an emotional week in Boston sports, beginning with David Ortiz. Authorities in the Dominican Republic have arrested six people in connection with Sunday's shooting there of the Red Sox legend. One of the suspects is believed to be the same man who's wanted by Pennsylvania authorities on a charge of attempted homicide. Authorities are still investigating possible motives in the Ortiz shooting. Boston Globe reporter Maria Kramer has been following this story. She's going to join us now from the Globe. Hello, Maria.
Hi.
Hi. Maria, you just came back from the Dominican Republic, and I think you're in touch with your colleague Amy Ortiz, who's there now. Could you bring us up on the latest? What do we know?
Yes. So this this pool of suspects is just getting bigger and bigger. There are now, we've just learned, two inmates who have been questioned or being questioned in connection with the shooting of David Ortiz. So this is just adding to the list of suspects that police say are involved in, were involved in this coordinated attack on essentially the most beloved sports figure in the Dominican Republic.
There are a lot of rumors and theories swirling out there. What do we actually know about the why, Maria? Have the authorities said anything about that?
No, we know nothing about the why. And as you said, there are so many rumors swirling, some very salacious, some, you know, and it's, you can't go into any of them because you don't know what's going to turn out to be true. A lot of information has gone out to the public that has had to be taken back. So you have to be very careful with what you're hearing from sources and even sources that you trust. The motive has not been revealed. And I think people are frustrated. They want to know, why would somebody do this to someone so beloved?
There's been, you've given us some information about the suspects. That list seems to be growing. Is there anything else about the suspects who have been arrested that we should know about or that is important to understand for some context here?
Yes, I mean, Amy Ortiz, as you said, is in the Dominican Republic now, and she has been going to the neighborhoods where some of these suspects are from. These are very poor neighborhoods, and getting people to talk there has been difficult. People have been very nervous, scared to talk about these suspects, and so we don't know very much about them right now, except that they come from very poor neighborhoods, and the people there are quite frightened to talk about what's been going on. We do know that the suspects who were apprehended yesterday, or whose names were released to the public yesterday, I should say, will be going before a judge today at some point in the evening. And there are reporters standing by, including Amy Ortiz, who are waiting for these men to be brought before a judge and formally charged.
Maria, you mentioned how beloved Big Papi is both here and in the Dominican Republic. They love him in his home country. A lot of people are wondering why not only somebody would want to do this to him, but how were they able to do it? It was brazen. You know, I read there were officers nearby when the shooting happened. Is there something about law enforcement in the Dominican Republic, or lack thereof, that would embolden people to be this brazen?
I think that's a really good question. That's one of the things that people are examining right now. That's one of the questions that you have a lot of people in, on the streets of the Dominican Republic asking themselves. If he's not safe, if a figure like you know, Big Papi, like David Ortiz, isn't safe in this country, then what hope is there for us? Others, of course, are saying, please keep this in perspective. You know, this is a country that really thrives on tourism, and they don't want to scare people off. It's a beautiful country. You know, Americans are especially they're especially worried about the American perception of the country because they rely so much on tourism from the United States, and so they want people to keep perspective. This was not a random attack. Is what the police have been saying.
Well, there's been some controversy, or there's been some concern about safety and security after a series of mysterious deaths of tourists in the Dominican Republic. Is that right?
Correct. Yes, you've had tourists dying and you know nice hotels and in touristy parts of the country. So the attack on David Ortiz, you know, at a popular nightclub in a section of the city where a lot of celebrities like to hang out, that's the last thing that the people of the Dominican Republic needed.
Yeah. Now David Ortiz is still in the hospital at Mass General. Can you give us an update on how he's doing?
He remains, he remains hospitalized, and he's doing well. Those are the reports we keep hearing, that he's very lively. You know, the big personality that we know of Big Papi is shining through. The people who are going to visit keep telling us. So he seems to be recovering quite well. It looks like the doctors in the Dominican Republic did a fantastic job addressing the very, very, very serious wounds that he received from the bullet. I mean, he sustained quite a lot of damage to some important organs, and so the recovery is going to be long, but people are optimistic that he's going to be okay and he's going to recover.
Yeah, and that is a really important physical recovery. I think a lot of fans are also just worried about him. He loves to be out in public. He loves to be connected to his communities. Is this going to change that for him? He's a truly public figure in the truest sense of that word.
Right, correct. In Boston and in the Dominican Republic, I think that's one of the reasons why he's so popular. You know, he's out there. He's out there with the people. And his father was actually asked that at one of the earlier press conferences. This was just after Big Papi was transferred from Boston from Santo Domingo to Boston. Do you think that your son is going to keep going out in the public? And his father said, you know, that's how my son has always been. He has friends from a long time ago that he likes to be with and likes to go out with. And as much as I don't want him out there, I can't stop that side of my son. But we'll see. This is a very big scare that he's gotten. So, it's a very traumatizing event. We'll see how this affects him in the long run.
Yeah. Boston Globe reporter Maria Kramer, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's turn now to WBUR Sports and Society reporter Shira Springer. Shira, thanks for coming in after a long night.
Thanks for having me.
Shira, let's continue with David Ortiz for a minute and give us, if you would, your first reaction to the latest news and what we heard from Maria just now.
Yeah, I think the salient things that Maria talked about were, you know, we've gone from will he be okay? Will he live, quite frankly, to what the heck happened here? And it is a bit frustrating with all of these rumors that are circulating and not knowing, and the information that comes out and then is retracted. And I think, you know, fans of Big Papi and just the population in general are going to maybe have to deal with the fact that we may never know why there was this targeted hit against such a beloved sports figure. As Maria said, the most beloved sports figure in the Dominican Republic. And then I think the other question, which is a little less important in some ways, is what kind of Big Papi comes out of this? Is he going to be the same guy that we know and love and who has been out and about and just, it seems, almost everywhere in Boston with charities and at the ballpark and just really not only a face of the Red Sox, but a face of the city in some ways. And is he going to be that same guy? Again, less important question than why was he targeted and how is his health going to be long term? But I think something will really be missing if we don't get that same, if that's not part of the full recovery.
Yeah. And as he recovers, of course, I hope he'll and his family will take sort of comfort in knowing city's going to love him no matter what.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there have been regular updates from the Red Sox, and Tiffany Ortiz, his wife, has put out those updates through the Red Sox. And in each of them, she thanks the fans for the support. And there's a real recognition that this city is behind him and sort of willing him to a full recovery.
Yeah, so we're going to continue to watch this story as it evolves. We love our athletes.
Mm-hmm.
We also love our teams.
Mm-hmm.
And it's time to talk about one of our teams. I don't think we can avoid it any longer. Last night was
as much as we'd like to avoid it, I think.
It was another massive heartbreak in Boston sports last night.
Yeah.
For the first time in their history, the St. Louis Blues are the Stanley Cup champions.
It hurts. Fans are reeling from this 4-1 Bruins loss in Game 7, Stanley Cup. Tell us what's on your mind. You were there.
Yeah, I mean, it was just tough. It was absolutely tough to watch. I mean, it starts out in the first period and, you know, the Bruins look good. They're the dominant team. They're aggressive. Not only, you know, are they aggressive, but they're, you know, they have more shot attempts. I think they finished the first period, it was 22-8 in shot attempts in favor of Boston. So early on in the first period, it was like, okay, they're ready for this big moment. And then, of course, as we all know, those two goals in the first period, the last one coming with 8 seconds left in the first period. And that just was a real momentum killer.
Yeah, it was. Morning Edition senior news writer Sarah Rose Brenner talked to us about that and what that felt like.
The first 13 to 15 minutes, I was like, the Bruins are going to get a few pass. They have so much pressure. They look amazing. They look great. And then the Blues scored and everything. It was like, you know, when you pop a balloon and you hear the like slow hiss of all the air escaping. That's what it felt like. It felt like all the air went out of the team. It went out of the garden. The fans never got back into it. And I watched the whole thing, and it was awful.
So what happened? I mean, we've heard the team wasn't playing at its best, but what happened?
I think, you know, first of all, you have to look at rookie goalie, you know, the Blues rookie goalie, Jordan Binnington. I mean, he was phenomenal. I think there was a frustration on the part of the Bruins. As I mentioned, they were out shooting the Blues by a significant margin, and they weren't getting anything past Binnington. So that frustration is building throughout the first period. And then you have those two goals. And I think, you know, after the first one, you're saying, okay, maybe you can get back there. You know, I mean, it's a one-goal deficit. But then again, that was the killer at the end of the first period. Alex Pietrangelo, captain of the Blues, and it just was like, whoa, with Binnington playing the way he's playing, we're not getting anything past him, and now we've got a two-goal deficit. And I think that really was a killer. And then I think you thought, all right, you know, there's an intermission. They can regroup. Maybe Patrice Bergeron said, you know, has another phenomenal pep talk, you know, in the middle of the game, and they're going to pull things together. And then to, I think, everyone's astonishment in the garden, they came out flat in the second. It was like they were almost overwhelmed by the moment and overwhelmed by the deficit. And this resilient team that we had seen all season just wasn't there. It was a shadow of what we had seen earlier. And I think that's part of what was so disappointing about this loss was that, you know, it's one thing if you come out in a game seven winner take all and you play your best, you feel you've left it all out on the ice. And I think clearly that wasn't the case for the players. I mean, that was certainly the impression I got in the locker room afterwards. Even though they didn't quite say it, I think they all on some level felt when we had to have our best game, we didn't.
Yeah, yeah. You know, one of the things that I wondered last night while I was watching, we so heavily outshot them in that first period. And you've already talked about the incredible night that Binnington had as the rookie goalie for the Blues. But is it normal to have that kind of an imbalance in shots on goal and come out behind at the end of a period like that?
Well, I always find, you know, they always talk about puck luck in hockey. And you know, I mean, listen, nothing is normal in a game seven of the Stanley Cup final. But no, you would think that if you are out shooting, you know, the opposing team, if you're putting that much pressure on a rookie goalie, and don't forget, this was a goalie who, you know, when he had pressure put on him, I believe it was game five, was pulled from, you know, the game. And so, you know, you would think that he would crack a little bit, just a little bit, that
they
would find
some
weakness at some point. But, you know, normal, not normal, who's for us to say? But yeah, it was certainly kind of got you thinking, this is not the Bruins' night.
Yeah, so you were in the locker room afterward, and we've heard that they didn't think it was their night either. Tell us what you heard from the players.
Just a lot of devastation. Absolute devastation. I think one of the players that really stuck in my mind was Matt Grzelcyk. We all know him. He's a kid brought up in Charlestown, grew up a Bruins fan. He missed four games because he, you know, suffered a concussion from a hit from behind. And he just talked after the game about how difficult it was to miss those four games and how special this team was. And here's what he said.
Probably the worst thing as a player is having to sit and watch. Not being able to go out there and battle with the guys, so just kind of a lot of things going through my head right now. It's really tough.
You can hear the pain there.
Yeah, you could hear it and you could see it. I mean, Brad Marchand, red eyes, looked like he'd been crying. You know, Patrice Bergeron, tough time talking. All of them had a tough time putting their thoughts together.
Yeah, it's a passionate team and it's a heartbreaking loss. We've got just a few seconds left. I do want to ask you, how do the Bruins move forward after this? Is there another shot next year? You know, what comes next?
Yeah. I mean, listen, if you're making it to the Stanley Cup final, you've got you do have a shot, of course, next year. And hey, look, the Blues were the worst team in January in the NHL and
yeah,
their
that's
Stanley
a good
Cup
point.
Stanley
that's
Cup
a good point.
So I think the point is there, you always have a chance. But they have a good group of veterans, and then as we've seen throughout the playoffs, Matt Grzelcyk is part of this younger core. They have a real good younger core too coming up. So I think the combination of both, you know, next year, maybe the next couple years, they'll be in the mix for a Stanley Cup final. But I think they're all cognizant of the fact that this kind of opportunity doesn't come along often.
Yeah, well, there is some hope there, though. WBUR Sports and Society reporter Shira Springer, thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use. And we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
It is the so-called post-truth era. It's an age of alternate facts where scientists are left scratching their heads at how to talk about many really important issues that we're currently facing. For example, it was just 4 years ago that a member of Congress brought a snowball to the Senate floor as proof that climate change doesn't exist. And just listen to how President Trump talked about climate change while speaking with Leslie Stahl on 60 Minutes last fall.
I'm not denying climate change. But it could very well go back. You know, we're talking about over millions of years. They say that we had hurricanes that were far worse than what we just had with Michael.
Who says that? They say. You mean the people on the phone?
People say that in the...
Yeah, but what about the scientists who say it's worse than ever?
You'd have to show me the scientists because they have a very big political agenda, Leslie.
I can't bring them in.
Scientists also have a political agenda.
Lee McIntyre is a research fellow at the Center for Philosophy and History of Science at Boston University. He has a new book called The Scientific Attitude, Defending Science from Denial, Fraud, and Pseudoscience. And he joins me now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston, Lee.
Thank you so much.
So why'd you write the book?
Well, I'm a philosopher of science, so I've always been interested in the question of what's distinctive about science. But one thing that occurred to me now in particular is that science is under attack. Science really needs to be defended. So it's no longer just of academic interest what's the difference between science and non-science. I thought that philosophers really needed to make a contribution to say, what's different about science and how can we use that to fight back against science denial, fraud, and pseudoscience?
One of the things that was really interesting was this concept of the scientific attitude, which is in the title of the book. I know you wanted to focus on attitude and values in science as opposed to something like the scientific method. Why was that the important thing to emphasize?
Well, about 100 years ago, philosophers started to try to solve something called the problem of demarcation, which is this formal logical method for figuring out the difference between science and non-science. And it hasn't worked. It's been 100 years, and which means that we've had 100 years of not really being able to defend science. And I got to thinking about it, and what it seemed to me was really distinctive about science was the set of values that scientists have. I think of the scientific attitude as being, first, that scientists care about evidence, but second, that they're willing to be open to new evidence changing their mind. It's the second part that's really crucial. That's the distinction.
Why is it so important to be open to changing your mind?
Well, if you think about how an ideologue approaches an empirical question, they're not open to changing their mind. If you show them evidence, they'll discount the evidence or they'll say, we'll wait till more evidence comes in. They'll find any excuse not to change their mind. But in science, because the value is you have to get it right. And if you don't get it right, your colleagues are going to get it right for you. They're going to test it and maybe humiliate you if you're not following the rules. That's something that scientists live by. It's really the creed of science that you need to live and die by the evidence. And when the evidence says, you know, maybe you want to believe that your theory is true, but the evidence says that it's not true, you have to modify or eventually give up the theory.
So we've been kind of talking about this moment that we're in and why it's important to write this book now. But, I mean, you can go all the way back to Galileo and further. We've always had people who are either denying of a new scientific discovery or they're anti-science or they're skeptics of science. Is there something different going on now or is this just a repeat of previous history?
Well, you're absolutely right. Science denial has been around as long as science has been around. Look back to Galileo, Giordano Bruno, Semmelweis. These are all famous cases. cases of resistance to science. Modern science denial really started in the 1950s when the big tobacco companies were faced with this new study that was going to show a fairly definitive link between smoking and lung cancer.
Interesting.
And they fought it by bringing in a public relations expert who said, you've got to start your own research institute. You've got to mount a public relations campaign. And that became the model for modern science denial. That story is very well told in Naomi Oreskes and Eric Conway's book, Merchants of Doubt. And what happened is that became the blueprint or the model for climate change denial, evolution denial, anti-vax. It all started in the 50s. Fast forward to the last two decades, the internet has been terrible for science denial.
Why has the internet been such a problem?
Well, I remember in the late 1960s, I heard from my mom, I think, that there were some people who thought that we hadn't gone to the moon. And I thought, how could this be? This seemed very strange. And I mean, so back then there were people who thought we hadn't gone to the moon, but you'd never met one. They didn't have any way to get their word out. Now they do. Now, just about any idea that you have, you can find confirmation for it on the internet. And I think that this has led to a distrust of scientists. It's led people to think that they're their own experts and they can just go down this rabbit hole or silo or whatever metaphor you want to use to feed that confirmation bias to think that they're right and the scientists are wrong. And that's been disastrous for science.
Now, Lee, one of the promises of the internet was to connect people. And one of the things that's come up, I think, both in your book and other places, is that scientists often disengage and don't engage with someone who says, I don't believe in climate change, or I don't think the science is settled, or evolution is just a theory. What's the dialogue that's important to happen? And is it a mistake for scientists to not engage with people who are skeptical or not buying into scientific discovery?
I think it is a mistake for them not to engage, but I mean, really, can you blame them? You heard the clip from Trump. I mean, those sorts of claims that scientists are in it only for the money or that they've got a political agenda. I mean, that's just not how science actually works. And so I think when scientists confront science deniers, their reflex is to present their evidence. And then when their evidence isn't accepted or their integrity is questioned, they walk away.
Is it necessarily a problem, though, to be skeptical of scientific fact? I mean, one of the things that your book talks about is you've always got to be open to the possibility that you're wrong, that new data could come along and refute what you've been arguing.
No, it's a great point, but that has to be done in good faith, right? That has to be done in such a way that the person is actually open to having their mind changed by the new evidence. And for science deniers, that's really not what they do. So what I'm recommending is that what scientists do more of is talk about how rigorous science is, talk about data sharing, talk about peer review, talk about replication and probability. It's a nerdy thing to talk about, but science cannot ever prove something 100%. It's not the same as deductive logic. That just doesn't work in the sciences. But I think that doesn't mean that scientific hypotheses or theories are not well warranted. And scientists need to say more about that. They need to own the fact that uncertainty is a strength rather than a weakness of science.
Now, to do that, you have to engage.
Yes.
And one of the things that I understand is that you do go out and engage.
I do.
I heard about a really fascinating experience that you had at a conference for flat earthers a few years ago. Is that true?
Yeah, it wasn't even that long ago. It was November 2018 in Denver, the Flat Earth International Conference. And I had my book, Scientific Attitude, was already in page proof. So it was already done. And I thought, I'm recommending that scientists follow this advice to get out there and engage with science deniers and talk about their values. So I'm going to do it. And so I bought the badge and I went. And the first day, I didn't say anything. I just listened. But the second day, I engaged. I mean, there were 600 absolutely true believers there. Some of my friends in advance said, well, they're just goofing. They're just trolling. They don't really believe it. They absolutely believed it and made the claim that they had evidence for flat Earth, which was what the seminars were about. So I took notes. I mean, I knew all of their arguments. So the second day, my claim against them was I wasn't going to present them with evidence because it had been around for 2,300 years and they didn't believe it. So what I did was I said the question we talked about earlier, what would it take to prove you wrong? And they couldn't answer it. And if you can't answer that question, you're not a scientist. You're not following the scientific attitude. You're not actually caring about evidence.
So here's part of what I'm struggling with in that. One of the things that your book talks about is the importance. Okay, so you can't prove something for forever and a day because there could be new evidence. You have
That's
to be
right.
open to the possibility that you're wrong. But you also talk in your book about the fact that repeated experimentation and trial and data can create believability.
That's right.
Okay. So then I think what's on my mind is, but if the threshold is believability, one can make many things believable. So how do we find that intersection of increased data is
yeah.
important for believability, but there are many ways to create. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And I think that the important point is that even though scientists can't reach certainty, they aim to get as close as they can. So there are degrees of believability. Okay, I'll give you an example. I just read in Reuters the other day that the evidence for climate change, anthropogenic climate change, is now at the five sigma level, which means it's a one out of a million chance that the science deniers that the climate change deniers are right. I mean, one out of a million. So, you know, you never go to a doctor who said he had a one out of a million chance of curing you. You know,
mm-hmm.
you wouldn't stake your life on that. So I don't understand why climate change deniers are willing to say, oh, well, until it's settled science, until all the data come in, which it'll never be, you know, we can't do anything about climate change.
Is the science on what to do about it settled?
Well, there are many different things that we might do. Those are in some ways policy debates or values debates. What I'm interested in is, in my book, what I'm interested in professionally is these sorts of political disputes over factual debates, which really shouldn't be happening. I mean, if somebody is willing to say, you know what, climate change is real, but it's not worth spending the money to do something about it, then we're having a values debate. We're not having a factual debate.
Mm-hmm.
The trouble that I have is that so many people don't understand that distinction, and they want to be able to say, well, I don't want to believe it's true, therefore it's not true.
So one of the things that you said, you've talked about it, values, and you've talked about it being politicized, policy.
Yes.
But this one does play out on both sides of the political aisle, and I want to make sure to mention that. Let's take GMOs, for example. Here's Dr. Peter Goldsboro. He's a professor of botany and plant pathology at Purdue. I want to hear from him for a sec.
The broadly held consensus by the vast, vast majority of scientists and medical professionals is that the GMOs that are currently available on the market have no health problems that are any different than conventional foods.
And yet environmentalists and others on the left, like Senator Bernie Sanders, have strongly campaigned. You got a label. You have to have labeling requirements for food products that include GMOs. So this is an issue from both sides of the political aisle. And sooner or later, scientific fact does affect policy. We can't just separate those two conversations. So our listeners... there's a listener somewhere out there who's thinking about where policy meets science, and pretty soon they're going to be at a family event where they're going to talk to some family member who sees a scientific fact differently or doesn't agree with it or is denying it. What's the roadmap for that conversation? How do we help people have that in their own lives?
I think the thing that you've got to do is recognize that for some people, belief about empirical subjects can be emotional. The one that comes up the most these days that you read about in the news is anti-vax. Anti-vaxxers love their children just as much as anybody else does, and they're afraid, and they don't know what to believe. They're confused. This is a good example where the science is absolutely clear. The study that Andrew Wakefield did has been debunked, shown to be a fraud.
This was a published document, a scholarly journal article,
yes,
that has been the basis for most of the anti-vax argument. Is that correct?
Yes. It was his spurious claim that there was a link between vaccines and the MMR vaccine and autism. So I think the way to talk to people about this is, number one, to talk. People change their – so I'm a connoisseur of the literature about how people change their minds on this, on climate change, on vaccines, on GMOs.
How do they?
Well, it's based on trust. It's based on one-on-one individual conversations. So, for instance, I went to the Flat Earth Convention, which, I mean, I didn't maybe build a lot of trust, you know, 600 to 1, because I was definitely the outlier. But I took people to dinner. I talked to them. I spent the time. I was there for the full 48 hours. I really tried to build trust just by showing up, by taking the argument seriously, as you can. I mean, taking the person person seriously, not the argument, the showing respect, not insulting somebody. These all help. If you look at the literature about how people change their mind about empirical topics, they almost always do so from a one-on-one one-on-one engagement with somebody who they trust who helped them to change their mind.
And were you able to better understand the perspective of the people at the Flat Earth Conference having built that trust? Were they more open and were you able to have a higher quality discussion?
In some cases, yes. But I have to say what I came away with was the understanding that quite a number of them were conspiracy theorists. So while I can't say that I understand that because I don't believe in the conspiracy theories that they do, I did come to understand that from their point of view, quite a number of them were truther conspiracists about 9/11. And some of them said that they became radicalized by that because a government that could lie to us about 9/11 could lie to us about Flat Earth.
All right. So before we end, I just need one hopeful sentence. One hopeful sentence.
Engagement.
All right. Great. All the way down to a word. Lee McIntyre is a research fellow at the Center for Philosophy and History of Science at Boston University and author of The Scientific Attitude, Defending Science from Denial, Fraud, and Pseudoscience. Lee, thanks for coming with.
Thanks so much. I enjoyed it.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Tomorrow is Flag Day. And if you didn't know that, I don't blame you because I did not know that either. But there are multiple debates going on right now over state flags here in New England. In Maine, the state legislature made a recent push to change their flag. Here's a report from Channel 8 in Maine.
Representative Janice Cooper of Yarmouth sponsored that bill. She wants to lose the current blue flag with the coat of arms and go back to a beige flag, which depicts only a pine tree and the North Star.
And here in Massachusetts, activists and a group of state lawmakers are arguing to change our own state flag, saying that its imagery is offensive. This is from a Fox News report.
The flag depicts a Native American with a bow and arrow just over his head, a disembodied arm with a sword. Many Native Americans find it offensive and are demanding a change.
Both the Maine and Massachusetts flags are state seals on a solid background, and though they're disliked for different reasons, flag experts say they have one big similarity, which is bad design. Ted Kay is a flag expert. He's the secretary of the North American Vexillological Association, which is devoted to the scientific and scholarly study of flags. He joins me now from Portland, Oregon. Ted Kay, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Tiziana, and congratulations on your new role and for pronouncing vexillological correctly.
Thank you for that credit. I didn't want to point it out, but I practiced all day, so thank you very much, Ted. Listeners, we want to hear from you. Do you think the Massachusetts flag is offensive? Do you even know what it looks like? Should Maine go back to its simple and, I will say, beautiful pine tree flag? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or tweet us at Radio Boston. Ted Kay, you compiled a book that's called Good Flag, Bad Flag, and you lay out in it what you argue are five foundational principles of good flag design. Can you tell us what those are?
Yes, I compiled the book based on the writing of many people who had looked at flag design, and the key ideas that they articulated were five: simplicity, meaningful symbolism, basic colors, 2 to 3 colors, no lettering or seals, and distinctiveness.
So what are some well-known... Sorry, please, go ahead, Ted.
And it's on those that the Maine and Massachusetts flags founder.
Founder as in you don't like them, right?
Well, no lettering or seals.
Okay, so what are some of the well-known flags that do meet these principles? Can you give us some examples that people can probably call up in their own heads?
Let me give you flags that were rated the highest in a survey that our group, NAVA, did in 2001 of state and provincial flags in the United States and Canada. New Mexico was rated the highest, and in that same group was Texas, Quebec, Maryland, Alaska, Arizona, Washington, D.C., South Carolina. I would guess that for most of your listeners, at least one of those flags pops up as an image.
Yeah, for me, Texas did immediately.
Indeed.
Yeah. Now, all other controversies about the Maine and Massachusetts flags aside, where do they fall down on these five design principles for you?
A fundamental idea of flag design is that flags should be recognizable at a distance. They are usually seen on a piece of fabric, flying on a flagpole 50 or 100 feet away, flapping, and they're on a piece of fabric. seals are meant to be on a piece of paper, 18 inches from your eye, not moving, only on one side of that piece of paper. Seals do not belong on flags. We create a bad flag design when we put something on a flag that we can't even see once it's up there.
Okay, we are going to get to the Massachusetts flag in just a minute, and we've already got some callers coming in who want to talk about that. But I do want to touch on the Maine flag for just a second. We spoke recently to Brian Olson. He's an associate professor of biology at the University of Maine, and he is a big booster of this old state flag, the Lone Pine Tree and North Star. It's got kind of a buff background. He says going back to that flag could actually be a branding opportunity for the state.
I mean, really, if you want to get out into the outdoors and appreciate the wilds, you come to Maine, if you're anywhere on the East Coast or across the country, frankly. And that old flag from 1901, I really feel like that sings those gifts loud and clear.
Ted Kaye, what do you think? Could changing Maine's flag really bring more people to Maine, like Brian argues?
I can tell you that changing back to the 1901 flag design would be returning to a great flag design. And to the extent that great design helps with a branding strategy, I would guess that it would indeed help.
Listeners, we do want to hear from you. Do you want to change our state flag? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK or tweet us at Radio Boston. We're going to shift gears now to the Massachusetts state flag, and we've got callers coming in. So I'm going to take a couple of them right now, Ted. First, we've got Andy from Chelsea. Andy, what do you have to say about the state flag?
I'm just wondering, why is it the flag offensive all of a sudden? It's part of our culture, and I just think it's kind of a trend that's been going on in the United States of America to get rid of our history that we came from.
Andy, was the flag something that you'd seen before? Or were you aware of what's on it? Is this something you'd been thinking about? Or did it come up for you as we were talking about it today?
No, of course. I've seen it every day going to Chelsea High. The flag is in all of our state buildings, in the courthouse in Chelsea, in Chelsea High, in the police station. I saw it every day growing up.
So it's the image of your Commonwealth for you.
Exactly, exactly. It's the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, so I don't understand why all of a sudden it's a problem.
Thanks for that call, Andy. I'm going to bring a second caller in before we turn back to Ted Kaye. John from Worcester, tell us what's on your mind about the flag.
Hi, thanks for having me. I think you don't have to be Native American to be offended by the flag. It's quite offensive. In fact, it just depicts subjugation. And I felt that way since I moved to the state 30 years ago.
Thanks for that. I appreciate that comment. And this gets to this yin and yang of changing a historical marker like a flag. On the one hand, it may, and many argue in the case of the Massachusetts state flag, that it depicts something that's offensive and a violent part of our history. On the other, it is the history of the Commonwealth, and some people say don't erase that history. Ted, I am going to come back to you in just a minute, but I do want to point out, sorry, I lost my track for a second. Ted, let me come to you now. Where do the design elements of a flag come into creating these kinds of strong reactions to how they speak about our history?
I like to describe what I call the ugly baby syndrome. Every mother loves her baby, and two very strong reasons that she loves her baby are she's used to looking at that baby, and it's her very own baby. That idea of familiarity and proprietary nature also follows through with people's relationship with their flags. Your callers articulated those in different words. However, mothers can't change their babies. States can change their flags.
Go ahead, Ted. It's okay.
Flags can be changed. Many states are looking at changing their flags. And independent of the deep reasons to change the flag, offensiveness to some people, there are design reasons to change the flag to make the flag easily recognizable and symbolic of the state and distinctive from other flags. Many people don't know that about half of U.S. state flags have a seal on a blue background. They're virtually indistinguishable from each other at a distance. One response that some states do is that they say, oh, well, we'll write the name of our flag on the flag so people will know that it's our flag. So Kansas writes Kansas on it, and Montana writes Montana on it. Now, of course, if you look at on the back, it says Saznak or Annatnam. But we would
I never
be
thought of it that way, right? That's the those names in reverse on the back of the flag.
We would laugh out loud if a country wrote their name on their flag. Can you imagine a flag that said France on it?
I see your point. Yeah.
Why don't we laugh at states doing that? If you have to write the name of what you're symbolizing, your symbolism has failed you.
It's weak.
And yeah. the symbolism both on the Maine and the Massachusetts flags are too small for people to see them.
So, Ted, I don't want to get too far away from the two callers that we had, because while the symbolism is small, it clearly spoke to both of them one way or another. And I want to bring another voice into the conversation on that question. We have on the line, we reached out to Jean-Luc Pirite. He's the president of the board of the directors of the North American Indian Center of Boston. Jean-Luc, welcome to Radio Boston. Thanks for calling in.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Now, you find the Massachusetts flag offensive. Tell us why, Jean-Luc.
Yes, not only is it offensive, but, you know, over at the North American Indian Center of Boston, we tend to, like, take things out of the realm of how people feel personally or, you know, and dwelling over the history of things. We actually look at the public health aspects of, you know, what this sort of imagery is doing to our populations. When we talk about the flag, when we talk about mascots, when we talk about the perpetuation of Columbus Day over Indigenous Peoples Day, we look at the numbers, and we know that nationally 71% of the total population of Native Americans live in urban areas. Here in Boston, 12 to 13% of the Native American population is here local. And, you know, when we're looking statewide, 79% of our Native American students are graduating from high school, which is actually worse than a national average of 84.5%.
So, Jean-Luc, I'm sorry to interrupt you on that data, but as you talk about this, we may have many listeners who don't know what the Massachusetts state flag looks like. So could you, in your own words, describe the flag for our listeners, please?
Yeah, so this is actually, when we talk about, like, tribal consultation and actually representation of who our people actually are, the composition of the state seal, the figure that's on it is according to the regulations by the Secretary of the Commonwealth, is just a, quote, Indian. But, you know, how that figure was actually composed, we're talking about the proportions of the body are based upon a skeleton that was excavated during an archaeological dig. They took the head of an Ojibwe chief, Chief Little Shell, and put that as the face of the Indian on the flag. And so that imagery polices our bodies and tells us, you know, what an Indian should actually look like. And when you look at our community members, very few of them actually, you know, rise to that sort of imagery. And so it basically, you know, it almost in a way kind of erases us both, you know, on the flag, but then, you know, just kind of physically. So, you know, it all around, that's why it's offensive to us.
I really appreciate that, Jean-Luc. That's Jean-Luc Pirite, the president of the board of directors for the North American Indian Center of Boston. Jean-Luc, thanks for being with us today.
Sure. And I just wanted to just very quickly, maindigenousagenda.org. Thank you very much.
Oh, great. Thanks for that. So, Ted, I'll be back to you in a second, but we spoke earlier with State Representative Nika Elugardo, who's filed a bill in the Massachusetts State House to change the state flag. She says the current flag only partially represents the state's history, but she's also got a vision in that bill that she's sponsoring for what that flag should represent of Massachusetts and its diversity.
I would love to see a flag that represents a people that is an amalgamation of all who come with an innovative spirit and a willingness to work together. And that is the story that is the redeemed story of genocide and war and slavery. Ultimately, we all are gaining access to this beautiful democracy that we've created together through all of that pain.
Ted Kaye, you talk about the symbolism of being good to key design. It's one of those five principles. What kind of symbolism should the Massachusetts flag represent based on what you've been hearing?
Something that redounds to what Massachusetts residents see as their state. It could be as simple as a pine tree, which something like I'm channeling Maine now, that is something that everybody in Massachusetts can see. Yes, that's our symbol. I would caution against trying to do too much in the flag. The best flags are very simple. The Lone Star State of Texas has a star on it and a couple stripes, and that's it. Alabama has just a cross on it. Colorado has a big C on it. The point is, don't try to do everything with your flag.
Keep it simple.
But indeed, avoid symbolism that has become offensive. The debate over the Massachusetts flag and its Indian is very similar to the debate about the Confederate battle flag on state flags, especially Mississippi, and how that use of that symbol is offensive to a portion of the population.
Listeners, we love hearing from you. I want to turn to two more callers now. Chris from Norwood, thanks for calling in.
Oh, no problem. I recently considered flying the Massachusetts flag at my house, and upon learning about the symbology, I decided it wasn't for me. But in doing research, I found the flag of Colonial England.
Colonial really New England, wonderful. Is that right, Chris? Colonial New England?
Yeah, right. So it's like a regional flag. So it's I grew up in Rhode Island, and so living in Massachusetts, I felt like I really wanted a flag that celebrated the whole wonder of New England. And it turns out that we have one, and it's beautiful, and it's really simple, and it has a pine tree on it.
So that's great. Thanks for that, Chris. I was going to ask for a description of it, but your line's a little bit garbled. I appreciate your call. I'm going to go to Dawson from Spencer. Dawson, tell us what you called about for flags.
Yeah, so as like was talked about before, like a lot of Massachusetts' innovation and history is like really rich to me, and the fact that our flag is just the CO on it, on white, and it is kind of, you know, it doesn't really represent the, you know, deeper history, diversity, the culture of Massachusetts. So
Dawson, if you were
like
going to
something that would represent,
if you were going to have sort of an aspirational vision of what the flag should represent, what do you think is important to capture about who we are as Massachusetts?
I think definitely a part of the original 13 colonies. There are a couple of states that do represent that, sometimes with 13 stars. But, yeah, just also like the, you know, being one of the first colonies as well as in like, you know,
so
right
that,
after.
So that colonial heritage, and that originality. Yeah. That's great. Thank you, Dawson, for calling in. Ted, we rally around our sports flags here in Boston a lot. If we had a stronger state flag or city flag, do you think that could be an alternate rallying point? Is that part of the reason we love our sports logo so much?
Absolutely. When the city and state flags are poor designs, that design territory is ceded to sports flags. So people love flying good flags. The second to last caller showed his enthusiasm in flying that flag. And I like to say that a great state deserves a great flag, and neither Massachusetts nor Maine have great flags, but they can have them. Not having great flags officially for their states, they look to their sports teams for the branding, for the logos, for the flags. In Nebraska, which also shares with Maine a blue background with a seal on it, we call those SOB flags, by the way.
Please tell our listeners what SOB stands for.
SOB stands for seal on a bed sheet.
Ah.
Nebraska's flag is very, very flown very – it's unusual to see the Nebraska flag, but the big block N flag of the University of Nebraska is all over the state. And that's an example of ceding the territory to the sports team logos when the regular flags are falling short.
Yeah. Ted Kaye is the secretary of the North American Vexillological Association. He's also the compiler of Good Flag, Bad Flag, a guide to flag design. Ted, thanks for joining us.
NAVA.org. Thank you very much.
Well, that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.